is an attack on their national identity as well as their land. I'm Robert Inlakesh, and I've come here to occupied Palestine to investigate what the so-called deal of the century means for the Palestinian people and the future of Palestine.
Following the official release of the controversial plan proposed to end the Palestine-Israel conflict, an escalation of violence ensued in occupied Palestine as Israeli occupation forces brutally attacked Palestinian demonstrators, only to strengthen the resolve of the Palestinian national resistance. Being on the ground in Palestine, I lived through this round of violence, witnessing vivid scenes of brutality, racist hate crimes, and the murder of Palestinians. But before we investigate this further, we have to first look at the past to understand how things got to where they are today. The peace process between Palestinians and Israelis, as it is often referred to, was officially initiated with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. When PLO leader Yasser Arafat signed the agreement with the Israelis, it was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state and the ending of hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis. However, a Palestinian state, as well as peace in the Middle East, never came. Instead, the Oslo Accords had meant for the newly established Palestinian Authority that they had accepted an exclusively Jewish ethno-state on 78% of their historic homeland and received nothing in return. 5 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was even more deeply entrenched as Israeli settlements expanded on Palestinian land. The only difference on the ground, as peace talks had been ongoing, was that there had been further theft of Palestinian West Bank resources, the besiegement of Gaza, and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. All of this whilst the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, had acted to protect Israeli security interests. Then, following the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, the illegal separation wall was later built in 2002 in the West Bank, usurping approximately 10% of the territory, also collectively punishing 150 Palestinian communities who were disconnected from their lands, according to the human rights group B'Tselem. Settlements continued expanding and the further confiscation of land and resources from Palestinians ensued, with illegal religious extremist Israeli settlers seizing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem as well as in the West Bank, all of this being justified by the Israeli claim the Palestinian terrorists had to be subdued and Israel's security had to be protected. Now, Donald Trump's self-proclaimed roadmap to peace would essentially allow for Israel to take half of the West Bank, annexing the most fertile agricultural lands, aquifers, and prohibiting Palestinians from having an army or any real autonomy. It would also connect Palestinian Bantustans together via underground tunnels. Upon arriving in occupied Palestine, I had traveled to the village of Kafin near Tulkarm, where an unarmed 19-year-old boy named Badr was shot in the neck and killed by Israeli occupation forces for protesting against the deal of the century. Unfortunately, this was not the last funeral that I attended of young people and children who had been murdered in the West Bank. However, they all resembled each other roughly. Palestinian family members grieving, the look of disbelief on a broken mother's face, and the cries from the village for a day where the martyrdom of their brother or sister will enable a free Jerusalem al-Quds, a belief that gives meaning to the life of those martyred. Al-Quds is at the heart of every Palestinian. It is holy to both Muslim and Christian Palestinians who are currently unable to visit if they live in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, or Palestinian diaspora. The international consensus for a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict states that East Jerusalem is to be the capital of the future Palestinian state. This, however, is not what is being allocated to the Palestinians under the Trump-Netanyahu vision. Instead, they are confining the capital of the Palestinian people to outside the separation walls of Jerusalem al-Quds.
I'm standing here in Abu Dis, the proposed capital for the Palestinian people. And of course, Abu Dis here is a suburb just outside of mainland Jerusalem al-Quds. And what we see here in Abu Dis is the apartheid system in the West Bank at its most clearest. We see over here behind us Palestinian villages, Jerusalemites, separated from their brethren and their lands on the other side of the wall over here. People who have been separated so that they cannot see their family members, that they cannot come and farm their lands, and of course separated by this wall. If this was to be accepted as the capital of Palestine, that would mean not only would it be this little slither of land, which would not include the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, but it means that it will be a symbol of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And for them to live like this, seeing every single day what could have been, and Jerusalem al-Quds with Masjid al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rocks in the background, is utter pain and struggle.
This separation of Jerusalemite Muslims and Christians from Jerusalem al-Quds is rarely ever shown on mainstream Western television. And so, before you travel to the West Bank, one would imagine that the situation is completely different from the reality faced here. What my cameraman and I witnessed on the Palestinian side of Israel's wall was the humiliation of Palestinians on a daily basis, and a space allocated for a capital which would hardly drive tourism to a country with its depressing scenery, bringing with it a feeling of walking around in an open-air prison. Even on the other side of the wall, Palestinian homes are constantly being demolished and stolen by Israeli settlers, as Donald Trump emboldens their actions with the decree that Israel's undivided capital is to be Jerusalem al-Quds. The justification given by Israel for such disturbing realities imposed on the ground is that what has been imposed is for Israel's security. But even if that was the truth behind the occupation and violations of international law, this excuse was not accepted internationally by the court of public opinion when it came to apartheid South African whites. So why is it reasonable coming from Israeli Jews, I ask? But the issue of division isn't the only problem facing the Palestinians. There is also the problem of where the two divided peoples would live if remaining segregated, and where any viable borders could possibly exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. The issues of borders is of course made tough due to the Israeli illegal racial colonies, or settlements as they're referred to.
Something that you cannot escape when you come here to the West Bank is seeing and witnessing how deeply entrenched these settlements are into the Palestinian land here.
Currently, over 750,000 illegal Israeli settlers live on stolen Palestinian land, equating to a land grab of 40% of the West Bank. Due to seizure of land, Palestinians currently live in 165 disconnected islands surrounded by checkpoints, military outposts, closed military zones, and settlements. What is perhaps more disturbing, however, is the fact that one of the chief architects of what is supposed to be a peace deal, Jared Kushner, has direct ties to the funding of an illegal settlement named Beit El, with almost $100,000 that we know about. Kushner is also an open supporter of illegal settlements. Understanding that under Trump's so-called peace plan, settlements will remain in place, I traveled to occupied Al-Khalil, or Hebron as it's called, to meet with local human rights activist Issa Amro to learn more about what the situation would remain as in the heart of the illegal settler conflict zone.
Trump's plan is to make this permanent. Trump's plan is about, legitimizing the settlements and legitimizing this apartheid and segregation and separation and keep me without any basic human rights. They don't want us to film their weakness and their truth. They don't want us to expose that Israel is an apartheid state, Israel is not a democracy, and Israel is not a state of law. It's the state of settlers, soldiers, and it's the state of apartheid and segregation. So the street is closed, all the shops are closed by military orders, and marked as closed shops. Look, it's marked, sealed, welded as closed shop. It was closed first 1994 after the Ibrahim Mosque massacre.
And what justification do they give? Why do they say they have to be closed? Do they give you a justification for closing it?
Always, always. The false justification is security. The main reason for it, it's about confiscation and to have the Arab free zone here. Closing the city center. It's the hub of the city, you know. It's the heart of the city. They closed it and they control it and they drive here. We are not allowed to drive. We are not allowed to drive in our own streets. Our shops are closed. Our houses became empty. They changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic name to Israeli Hebrew names. The road signs are only in English and Hebrew. Israeli flags here, they are taking our identity as Palestinian identity.
And this system right here with the shops closed and everything happening, under Trump's plan, this would remain closed?
It will remain closed. They didn't touch it. They didn't talk about it. The main entrance to the family is closed. The main road is closed. And we are using the fields to reach the house here. And the family is separated and isolated alone. And the army is occupying the roof. They have a military post on the roof. The family is not allowed to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they are locked inside the house. And from time to time, the settlers come to the roof, throw stones, throw rocks, throw rubbish to the family without any help. Not only that, the Palestinian ambulance is not allowed to reach here without a special coordination. So you skip all the emergency cases. Mm-hmm. So you are not only sieged by the army and the soldiers, you are seized from any kind of basic human rights.
We continued until we reached a military outpost, where we were at first instructed at gunpoint to go back because Palestinians could not walk on the Jewish-only street there. So we filmed secretly as I asked the soldier present why Aysa and my cameraman Hamdi were not able to walk on the road. The soldier I just engaged with refused to speak to me until I told him I was not a Palestinian. But many other soldiers had an even more negative attitude towards us, making it clear that Palestinians or any friends of Palestinians were not welcome. After witnessing the situation in Al Khalil, I then traveled to Ramallah in order to take part in protests rejecting the deal of the century. At this protest you're seeing alone, tens of protesters were shot and many others gassed, causing them to collapse and convulse.
We have an attack here on a member of the press, clearly marked as press. It's of course a violation of international law, firing tear gas everywhere. He passed out unconscious. This man is marked as a press and of course is not protesting. He's here to document purely, and he was targeted by the Israelis.
After the demonstration, we found out following a visit to the Ramallah hospital that four young boys were shot with internationally banned bullets. Three were hit in the legs and one in the head. The protests I witnessed, however, were just the tip of the iceberg. Other demonstrations were much more violent and led to the deaths of several young Palestinians. To find out more about why Palestinian people broke out into mass protest against the deal of the century, I met with the world-renowned journalist Jana Jihad and Palestinian icon Ahed Tamimi, both locals to the village of Nabi Saleh.
So, since the announcement of the so-called
first
deal of
asking
the century,
Jana what she had witnessed since the announcement of the Trump plan.
As you said, are getting killed, people are getting arrested. I'm facing checkpoints on my way to school every day. Like, for example, yesterday, I was just going to my school and then there was this checkpoint. You know, the checkpoints here in the West Bank are not checkpoints. They're just a gate on the street. They usually close it, block the street, and then they go. They don't check the car, they just block it. So, like, I had to take another way that takes me about triple the time to get to my school. I was late to my school. Even today, we were stuck for 2 hours on the checkpoint. Every day since the deal of the century had been declared, you know, people, there are a lot of clashes, people are getting killed, people are getting injured, and it's very sad that we are paying the price of something that we didn't cause.
What we heard from Donald Trump was that when this deal was initially announced, that there would be some sort of peace that would come out of this, and that the Palestinians would receive a great amount of money.
I believe that legalizing what's illegal is not peace. Legalizing occupation, legalizing settlements, it's not what we call peace. And I don't care about money. I just want my land. I want to stay in my house. I want to go to the sea that I've never been to, which is only 30 minutes far from my house, that I can literally see every single morning from the roof of my house that I've never been to. That's what I call peace, but that's not peace. And I don't care about money. What if I came and told you I want half of America, I'd pay you, but I just want half of America? Like, what would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
In Ramallah, I witnessed the largest demonstration the city had seen since the time of the Second Intifada, or uprising as it is known in English. What was clear to me in the West Bank was that there was a growing sense of desperation and also unity from the Palestinian people that could be felt building day by day. The desperation for action coming from the threat immediately posed to annex areas such as the Jordan Valley, which is where I began to travel to next. So we've just entered the Jordan Valley here, and what we witnessed just as we were entering was the closed military zones here, and the soldiers in the fields actually aiming just above children and telling them to duck, using them sort of as firing practice. And then what we also discovered as we were driving along is that two Bedouin children, young children who were riding on donkeys, were also arrested by the army. The Jordan Valley is home to 70,000 Palestinians, yet is 85% inaccessible to its people, as Israel has turned the land into a military training ground and allowed for illegal settlers to come in and make goods to sell around the world. The area is under international law recognized as Palestinian land, which is to be the future agricultural hub of Palestine. Its undeveloped areas could also be used for energy projects, water extraction, and urban centers. One of the most important things to understand about the Jordan Valley is that this land here constitutes 30% of the West Bank, and of course means the loss of the most fertile agricultural land for a potential future Palestinian state. What you can see straight away when you come here to the Jordan Valley is that the people primarily here are building their houses as tents and as sort of cave structures and things like this, because the Israelis don't allow them here in Area C to actually build, have the permits to build homes. So if they were to actually build proper homes already before the land being annexed, and of course these people inevitably being expelled, then their homes would be bulldozed.
The conditions that have been imposed in the plan says that there is no Palestinian state. So what will happen with us? We are here more than 50% of the population. Now every year they demolish about 500 houses there. This plan says no Palestinian state and no sovereignty, no borders, no water, no air, no underground. Nothing for the Palestinians. In Jordan Valley, we are 70,000 Palestinians, and and the Israeli settlers are only 8,000. So we have to stay, and our existence there will be the main factor to stop the century plan.
It was clear from even before U.S. President Donald Trump, alongside Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, announced the details of the plan, that the Israeli regime sought to annex the Jordan Valley, northern Dead Sea, and illegal settlements, throwing away all the progress of work done since 1988 between Palestinians and Israelis. Looking on at the situation on the ground in Palestine, it was clear that a two-state solution looked impossible, and that a one-state solution where Palestinians could live with equal rights to Israelis was a long way from coming to fruition. However, the younger generation of Palestinians served as a great source of hope that one day liberation could perhaps be in sight, and that the failure of the old is now being replaced by a new vision for peace coming from the young.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Western world claims to practice freedom of expression while it is proved that this motto is just a lie. When it comes to Palestinians and the issue of resistance, freedom of expression is widely restricted. This is evidently seen today by the actions of Facebook and Instagram in violating the rights of Palestinians during the Gaza war. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. The website of Middle East Eye wrote, Facebook and Instagram's policies during Israeli regime attacks on Gaza last year harmed the fundamental human rights of Palestinians, according to a report commissioned by the platform's parent company, Meta. The study, which was carried out by a consultancy business for social responsibility, BSR, was obtained by The Intercept ahead of its publication recently. In May 2021, Meta was widely accused of censorship and bias during Israeli regime's assault on Gaza, which killed 256 Palestinians, including 66 children. Meta's actions in May 2021 appear to have had an adverse human rights impact on the rights of Palestinian users to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, political participation, and non-discrimination, and therefore on the ability of Palestinians to share information and insights about their experiences as they occurred, the report said. Middle East Eye reported last year that concerns had been raised about deleted social media content and account suspensions in relation to Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, where an Israeli crackdown on protests against forcible evictions sparked escalation in violence. According to the report, Meta deleted Arabic content related to last year's violence at a much greater rate than Hebrew language posts. This was found among posts reviewed by both automated services and employees. BSR attributed the difference in treatment to a lack of expertise. It concluded that Meta lacked staff who understood other cultures, languages, and histories, despite having over 70,000 employees and $24 billion in cash reserves. Potentially violating Arabic content may not have been routed to content reviewers who speak or understand the specific dialect of the content, the reporter stated. During the outbreak of violence, Palestinian and Arab social media users revived an old Arabic font in an attempt to beat Facebook's algorithm and express their support for Palestine. The BSR report fell short of accusing Meta of deliberate bias, pointing instead to unintentional bias leading to different human rights impacts on Palestinian and Arab-speaking users. It found that Meta's dangerous individuals and organizations policy referred to in the report as DOI, which prevents its users from praising or representing a number of groups, focused mainly on Muslim entities and therefore disproportionately impacted Palestinians. It said, Meta's DOI policy and the list are more likely to impact Palestinian and Arabic-speaking users, both based upon Meta's interpretation of legal obligations. Palestinians are more likely to violate Meta's DOI policy because of the presence of Hamas as a governing entity in Gaza and political candidates affiliated with designated organizations, the report said. The study concluded with 21 non-binding recommendations, which included increasing staff capacity to analyze Arabic posts and reforming the dangerous individuals and organizations policy. Meta vaguely committed to implementing 20 of the recommendations, according to Intercept. The company did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Its response to the report will be included when the document is published in full. In a footnote to the response seen by the Intercept, it said Meta's publication of this response should not be construed as an admission, agreement with, or acceptance of any of the findings, conclusions, opinions, or viewpoints identified by BSR, nor should the implementation of any suggested reforms be taken as admission of wrongdoing. According to Intercept, Facebook and Instagram's speech policies harmful fundamental human rights of Palestinian users during a conflagration that saw heavy Israeli regime attacks on the Gaza Strip last May, according to a study commissioned by the social media site's parent company Meta. Meta's actions in May 2021 appear to have had an adverse human rights impact on the rights of Palestinian users to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, political participation, and non-discrimination, and therefore on the ability of Palestinians to share information and insights about their experiences as they occurred, says the long-awaited report which was obtained by The Intercept in advance of its publication. Commissioned by Meta last year and conducted by the Independent Consultancy Business for Social Responsibility, or BSR, the report focuses on the company's censorship practices and allegations of bias during bouts of violence against Palestinian people by the Zionist regime forces last spring. Following protests over the forcible eviction of Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, Israeli regime police cracked down on protesters in the West Bank and launched military airstrikes against Gaza that injured thousands of Palestinians, killing 256, including 66 children, according to the United Nations. Many Palestinians attempting to document and protest the violence using Facebook and Instagram found their post spontaneously disappeared without recourse, a phenomenon the BSR inquiry attempts to explain. Last month, over a dozen civil society and human rights groups wrote an open letter protesting Meta's delay in releasing the report, which the company had originally pledged to release in the first quarter of the year. While BSR credits Meta for taking steps to improve its policies, it further blames a lack of oversight at Meta that allowed content policy errors with significant consequences to occur. Though BSR is clear in stating that Meta harms Palestinian rights with censorship apparatus, it alone has constructed the report absolves Meta of intentional bias. Rather, BSR points to what it calls unintentional bias, instances where Meta policy and practice combined with broader external dynamics does lead to different human rights impacts on Palestinian and Arabic-speaking users, a nod to the fact that these systematic flaws are by no means limited to the events of May 2021. Meta responded to the BSR report in a document to be circulated along with the findings. Meta did not respond to Intercept's request for comment about the report by publication time. In a footnote in the response, which was also obtained by The Intercept, the company wrote, Meta's publication of this response should not be construed as an admission, agreement with, or acceptance of any of the findings, conclusions, opinions, or viewpoints identified by BSR, nor should the implementation of any suggested reforms be taken as admission of wrongdoing. According to the findings of BSR's report, Meta deleted Arabic content relating to the violence at a far greater rate than Hebrew language posts, confirming long-running complaints of disparate speech enforcement in the Palestinian conflict. The disparity, the report found, was perpetuated among posts reviewed both by human employees and automated software. The data reviewed indicated that Arabic content had greater over-enforcement, for example, erroneously removing Palestinian voice on a per-user basis, the report says. Data reviewed by BSR also showed that proactive detection rates of potentially violating Arabic content were significantly higher than proactive detection rates of potentially violating Hebrew content. BSR attributed the vastly differing treatment of Palestinian posts to the same systematic problems rights groups, whistleblowers, and researchers have all blamed for the company's past humanitarian failures, a dismal lack of expertise. Meta, a company with over $24 billion in cash reserves, lacks staff who understand other cultures, languages, and histories, and is using faulty algorithmic technology to govern speech around the world, the BSR report claimed. Not only do Palestinian users face an algorithmic screening that Israeli regime users do not, an Arabic hostile speech classifier that uses machine learning to flag potential policy violations and has no Hebrew equivalent, the report notes that the Arabic system also doesn't work well. Arabic classifiers are likely less accurate for Palestinian Arabic than other dialects, both because the dialect is less common and because the training data, which is based on assessments of human reviewers, likely reproduces the errors of human reviewers due to lack of linguistic and cultural competence, it claimed. Human employees appear to have exacerbated the lopsided effects of Meta's speech policing algorithms. Potentially violating Arabic content may not have been rooted to content reviewers who speak or understand the specific dialect of the content, the report says. It also notes that Meta didn't have enough Arabic and Hebrew-speaking staff on the hand to manage the spike in posts. Beyond Meta's failures in triaging posts about Sheikh Jarrah, BSR also points to the company's Dangerous Individuals and Organizations policy, referred to as DOI in the report, a roster of thousands of people and groups that Meta's billions of users cannot praise, support, or represent. The full list obtained and published by The Intercept last year showed that the policy focuses mostly on Muslim and West Asia entities, which critics described as a recipe for glaring ethnic and religious bias. Meta claims that it's legally compelled to censor mention of groups designated by the U.S. regime, but legal scholars have disputed the company's interpretation of federal anti-terrorism laws. Following The Intercept's report on the list, the Brennan Center for Justice called the company's claims of legal obligation a fiction.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Oh, well, we have been discussing about physical development, cognitive development. What things ought to be kept in mind while you are developing your child, while you are bringing your child? And now we reach the emotional aspect. Professor Nakavi, what do we have in emotional development? What things, as a parent or as a trainer, we should keep in mind?
Yes, physical development and mental and cognitive development, as I said, go hand in hand. and they need to be balanced. They need to be brought up together. But you need to focus on things specifically to be able to reach those goals that we have.
Yeah.
The goals need to be determined in terms of the behavior that we expect from the child when he behaves as a child, and especially when he becomes grown up.
Yeah.
What type of behavior do we expect from him or her when she is grown up? Just as we mentioned previously, that if the girl is developed physically properly, when it comes to her behavior with her husband and her conduct with her husband, that plays a great deal of, you know, has a great deal of weightage in that relationship.
Yeah.
So when we talk about our thinking, the aim in our thinking and cognitive development is that the child, or when he becomes grown up, he takes proper decisions in life. He knows what are the strategic issues that he has to develop, understand. What are the tactical issues? What are the practical operational issues that need to be taken care of? He needs to be a good thinker, a clear thinker.
Yeah.
Well, in any aspect of life, he needs to be able to plan for himself. He needs to be able to plan and execute that plan, to be able to design and develop something for his life, manage his life, her life. So that needs cognitive development, that needs physical development, and especially the emotional development. For example, we are maybe very good thinkers, but when it comes to changing or translating our thoughts into actions, the feelings have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The motivation has to be there. The conviction has to be there. The proper attitude. The attitude means the behavior which we prefer to take up.
Yeah.
Do we prefer to, for example, go to bed without taking care of our, maybe as a child, we don't we just go to bed, don't take care of our clothes, wash our hands, or maybe go to the toilet, brush your teeth. So we know that is correct. That has to be done, but we're lazy.
Yeah.
We the motivation is not there to make us carry out what we have thought about.
Yeah.
We cannot, as we say, walk the talk.
Yeah.
We need to be able to do what we say.
All right.
So there the emotions play a very important role.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we develop that in a child? Then again, it comes back to us that how we perform and behave in front of them. If we make a decision, we are going out for an outing, we're going out for something together, then we need to stick to that.
Exactly. Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi, and we are discussing emotional development. Well, Professor, you said before going to the break that whatever we are doing, it should be motivational. We should have that motivation before, like, if a child wants to go for brushing his teeth, changing his pajamas, and going to sleep in proper time. Definitely, as parents, we have to provide the basic things before we
have role model.
Yeah.
And then we need to make him, we need to provide him this guidance that, look, in life, you want to achieve goals, and you want to be successful. And success is based on your actions, your conduct, your behavior.
All right.
The behavior should be proper. It should be doing the good things, carrying out good things in the proper way,
mm-hmm.
doing the right thing in the right way, but with the pure intentions, the pure motivation.
All right.
So we need to, as I said, channelize those feelings towards godliness. We need to make him realize that even if you're taking care of these small things in life, you're doing it for yourself, for the sake of becoming perfect, for the sake of becoming godly.
Yeah.
And this motivation should emanate from this love for perfection. And love for perfection is love for the absolute.
Yeah.
And love for the absolute is the love for Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
So this motivation has to be developed with the proper thinking and the channelizing of the feelings towards this proper thinking. That, look, whatever I do in this world is because Allah Almighty has given this capability and capacity to me, and has given me a responsibility, and he has provided the faculties I need.
And it's my test how I perform these.
Need to put them put them in the right place, use them in the right way. When the Quran says, if you thank me, I will increase your bounties.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Thanking Allah Almighty is not just thanking him verbally.
Yeah.
It's thanking him practically. Shukr is saying shukran lillah.
It's not enough.
That's not enough. Shukran lillah is employing the faculties he has given to us, the physical, the mental, the feelings, in the proper way. The proper way to thank him is to use these faculties in the proper way.
Yeah.
For what they are meant for the goals that we need to achieve in life. So this motivation, along with that cognitive development, has to be given. We need to make ourselves and our children realize that whatever we do in this world is for the sake of the hereafter. But the hereafter cannot be achieved. Salvation in the hereafter cannot be achieved without the perfection of this world.
All right.
So everything, all the time, we should be trying to inculcate this, that we have a moral compass to follow.
Okay.
Every time we deviate from that, we need to come back to it.
All right. That's very important.
That is Tawbah.
Yeah.
That is repenting.
All right. Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqvi. We're discussing about emotional development. Professor Naqvi, before going to the break, you're saying that our ultimate goal of life, our ultimate aim is to achieve proximity with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to get closer to Him, to get to flourish towards perfection, which is the ultimate aim.
Exactly. That flourishing would come in the form of our conduct and our behavior.
Okay.
But that behavior should come out and resonate with the feelings and our thoughts within.
Yeah.
So how do we inculcate that in our children? That is very important. That is the crux of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that can only be achieved if we have a sincerity of purpose, and we have a sincerity in our actions and purity in our actions. The guide, the trainer, the parent, in as much he or she is pure and has a conviction and performs in the proper way, that will reflect upon the child. So the purification of the child is directly proportional to the purification of ourselves.
Yeah.
So if we need to, we want to provide them that motivation, we can only make them realize the importance of these things. We need to
educate them,
and to infuse in them this understanding. Of course, it is a philosophical, rational understanding that cannot be carried out at a tender age.
Yeah.
But the upbringing should be such that in the future it leads to this understanding.
Yeah.
So the child, of course, a parent cannot do all of this together. He needs to put the child under the mentorship of a person who can provide this guidance. Even if a parent can't do it himself or herself, then he should be looking for a mentor or a guide for his children. And that is something which we are lacking in society today.
We don't have mentors.
We don't have people. When we talk about seer and suluk, traveling towards Allah, the journey towards Allah requires a person who guides us.
Yeah.
And shows us the path. He has traversed that path himself and becomes a guide for us and takes us along that path.
Yeah.
So in the absolute sense, that is the imam, that is the wali. But we need a wali coming down to our levels also. We do not have a connection with the imam of our times today.
We have to come to a lower level to provide that.
We have to find people at a lower level. Parents in the first stage, at the second level, we need to find such mentors.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi. And definitely with this program, we are providing a lot of information to actually reach that proximity. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lebanon's President Michel Aoun leaves the presidential palace at the end of his term amid continued uncertainty over his successor.